Great. Well, welcome, everyone. Again, I think we only have Paul on the phone with us today. I didn't have any word from anybody else, so we'll go ahead and get started. Wanted very briefly just to note, we have Kelsey Townsend, our a legal fellow, who's kind of working with us for a little while here, and want to thank her for helping out. And so, yes, we are unfortunately missing Rachel this morning to some viral something. And exactly, you know, it's the season. Our next meeting is scheduled for January 8th. So, you know, don't show up on New Year's Day, not the first Wednesday. The due date for this last set of materials is January 15th. I might be a little more open than usual to requests for extensions. let me kind of see, like, there is a possible federal shutdown threat again on the horizon, the holidays. You know, an 8-week time frame suddenly doesn't seem like as much time. So let me kind of check our calendar too and follow up with you by email. But I think we will probably give at least a 1-week extension on that, given the holidays. And, you know, honestly, if there's a significant shutdown, we can adjust further. So, you know, yeah. Yeah. So with that in mind, I just wanted to kind of mention, too, for everybody, I think I don't know, mentioned this before or piecemeal, just kind of, again, lay out path ahead. We are working again on at the staff level on a collective update to comments we've received really over the last 9 months, right? Since the kind of big across-the-board update we did last March. So we hope in February, at some point in February, to get up. How you doing? Paul's on the phone. Paul, just so you know, Don Brayman joined us. So our plan and expectation is in February to get out, again, another across-the-board update, taking into account, again, really the various comments on various pieces over this last 9 months. So that will be a big, obviously, volume of materials, but the like last time, we will detail our responses to each kind of proposal or comment that we received, right, since the last across-the-board update. So you know, we'll again have that Appendix D in all of our minds, which like catalogs, you know, here was the comment from PDS or OIG or USAO, and here's a response. In addition to, again, updating the statutory language and the commentary accordingly. So we'll try to streamline it as we can, but that's the plan. And, you know, we are working towards, as the end of the year approaches, in 2020, you know, we're working towards issuing recommendations. And that need not be the end of our work in the sense that we can continue, and there's still other offenses and defenses, but we would like to move out and hold a vote on kind of what we have so far. So while we do intend to kind of, again, move forward with the different offenses and defenses, we are also, first and foremost, in 2020, trying to get out, and that means holding a vote and moving on to the council and mayor for their consideration, recommendations on the main body of work, which, again, you've pretty much all seen. We've got a few more pieces to come into fall into place in the next few months. But that's the general path of things. Any other questions on that or other announcements before we kind of dive into talking about the comments we got back in Report 41? Great. I totally messed up too. I had grand visions of having something, a treat, because I realized there are multiple December birthdays in this room. I failed. Oh man, that means I have to make it up doubly in the new year, I think. Isn't that like the you know, or just like call it a meeting, we go down right now. Is that the deal? I know Dave has a birthday, I think Laura does, and anybody else is at least...
Sorry, I'll be in Vegas for my birthday next week.
Oh, no apologies. Anyway, well, again... you know, let's jump in then to the comments we got back on Report 41. And, you know, thank you all. I know, you know, this was in some ways a deceptively slim set of materials, right? Because to process it requires thinking through a lot of other issues. And so thank you all for your comments. We, I think, at the staff level have, you know, various questions, but I'm also very open to any questions you all have as you read each other's positions. They're very different sets of comments that we received back. Let me kind of turn to actually first an OAG comment and see what others think of this. Lose me now. There we go. This is on page 2. I'll bring it up on the screen. This is about the classification for non-consensual sexual conduct. The basic rationale, as I understand it from OAG, this is again page 2 of theirs, was
they... Which report are we on? Sorry.
This is the comments that you provided on Report 41.
Ordinal rank. Oh, it's my page. Mine must be out of order. Oh, that one. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Great. Right. So there was... The recommendation was that the penalty be raised... be commensurate with first degree arranging for a sexual conduct with a minor, and which I believe was at the class 8 level, the 5 or the 5 year level, 5-4 years as it was above, they noted above. And I wanted to be clear or make sure I kind of explain a bit where we were coming from in this offense, and then see if others kind of, if that changes OAG thinking or if others have comments on it. You know, non-consensual sexual conduct, as we had put it in the RCC, is an offense that really corresponds to current misdemeanor sexual conduct, right? Which, you know, right now is a 180-day non-jury demandable. We'll talk about jury demandability in a bit. But 180-day non-jury demandable offense that really is a catch-all, as it were, right? Like, it is, it includes conduct that is generally punished much more severely in many other forms, be it the arranging kind of current enticing statute in district law, be it various forms of sex abuse, be it sex abuse of a minor. Structurally, it plays a kind of a unique role in being a bit broader, right? It is any form of you know, sexual contact, sexual act, and it is couched a little differently, even in the current statute, as to being without permission versus without consent. So it's a little, it's a bit broader. But it's a kind of a low-level catch-all offense. our thought in revising this and putting forward the non-consensual sexual conduct offense was to actually increase the penalties somewhat when what was the conduct was a sexual act, right? So in other words, take kind of the current misdemeanor sexual conduct, the scope of that, and where it in where the particular conduct is a sexual act, we graded and made that first degree and suggested that be a felony level offense, even for this base, right? Like if it's a sexual act, a penetration type offense or oral sex, that's we thought merited a low felony designation. So that's where we were coming from with this. Now, the OAG comments, so a couple of things. You know, one, it didn't, the OAG, you know, the final line was a recommendation that the penalty for the offense be raised to be commensurate with first degree arranging, which, again, the first degree arranging for a sexual conduct with a minor is essentially, again, from our point of view, one, it's with a minor, limited to that. Two, it's essentially conduct that is, at the very least an attempt level, right? It's an effort to persuade that seems to rise to that standard. So again, where we'd gone with that offense was pretty much, you know, more in accord with current law, but with a very different purpose, right? The arranging conduct could extend to more conspiracy type, an agreement to get somebody else to, bring the kid to this location, et cetera. But it is ultimately an inchoate offense. There, you know, need not be a completed sexual contact, sexual act. And we did recommend it for, again, kind of a class 8. So, when you're looking at the comparisons, and there are many things to look at here, I just want to put that in mind. But I think, the first question, I think, to OAG is, what, for non-consensual sexual conduct, the final sentence here in the didn't kind of break out in first or second degree. It just kind of says, the penalty be raised to be commensurate. So I think, one clarificatory question is simply, should that be only the first degree requiring a sexual act or also second degree?
All right, so I'm trying to go through my chart.
Sure.
Can you go through, because I didn't put it in the memo,
yeah,
what the penalties are for the three of them? Because I'm trying to find first degree, second degree, and the one per applying to minor.
8, 9, and A. The ranging is 8. First degree is 9. Second degree is 8.
Yeah, I think we'd be open to second degree if that was what your question is.
What?
Well, right. So I think the current is 8, 9, A.
Yeah.
And then the question is...
8 first degree...
Eight for the arranging.
Nine for first degree, A for second degree.
Wait, what? Say it.
That's what we've currently got, is eight for arranging. The arranging statute.
Arranging.
That's what they're
that's what
OAG's
comparing it to.
Right.
Okay.
And then what we had was for first degree was to, again, kind of to bring it up from misdemeanor sexual abuse to a felony level class 9, and then keep at the this around 6 month mark. As a class A, actually, to raise that also to 1 year misdemeanor for the misdemeanor conduct. So, again, the initial question is just like, did you want to get rid of the gradations? Is that kind of what's implicit here? Or did you want just the first degree to go up to 5 years, but leave the second degree down?
Yeah, actually, I don't know that our proposal went that deeply.
Okay.
Basically, what's in that paragraph is pretty much what the thought in the office was, which was, notwithstanding that it's a minor, it's an inchoate offense. And it just seems odd that the inchoate offense would carry a lower penalty than a completed offense would.
You bet.
And that's pretty much what we wanted to bring to the attention of the commission to see if people felt that an adjustment was necessary. So we pegged it at first degree just because that seemed to make sense, but that doesn't mean that we're not open to the discussion.
Okay. Right. I guess I would say this. Again, structurally, what we're going for here is that more practically any conduct, right? The non-consensual sexual conduct is still in the RCC also a catch-all offense, right at the bottom. There are much more particular, sex abuse of a minor, penalties that are much more enhanced merely for a sexual contact with a minor. Right? But I guess what I want to point out is you can look at it as this is there are more serious versions of inchoate attempted sex abuse of a minor. First degree, second degree, third, like those would all also be more serious, much more serious. And so I think that comparison maybe isn't the best, and that what we're trying to achieve by this statute, by the non-consensual sexual conduct statute, is to have a lower level, I expect it will probably be used as a plea down offense frequently. The stat numbers already kind of show it is heavily used. The misdemeanors, the current misdemeanor sexual abuse.
Yeah, right.
Right. Heavily used. I don't know, offhand, but it's far outstrips all other charges combined. It's registry eligible. It does a lot of work.
Not for adults.
It's not registry eligible for adults?
Right. If you abuse an adult, it's not registry eligible.
Oh, right.
If you live in D.C., except in other jurisdictions, it could be.
Could be.
Like
great.
Maryland, it could be.
Good. Good. So this is, I think structurally it's occupying a different place, and we wanted to have a lower level. And we think that, that same basic pool of conduct is also almost in every respect penalized at some higher level in some other way, right? The one kind of exception goes particularly that the kind of uniquely falls, I think, under this, which is talked a lot kind of about lately, is the frozen fright type situations, right? Where there might be some real questions about the ambiguity of consent as an evidentiary matter. And, facing facts like that, this seems like a natural way to go under current law without permission. It's broader, doesn't have the pull in the same kind of definition of consent. We mimic that. So it might do a little bit of unique work, but really it's a catch-all kind of plea down that we thought we didn't want to get rid of, and it might have, and so, I don't know what other, PDS or USAO in particular would think about, were we to raise it, non-consensual, and again, then there's no misdemeanor sexual abuse equivalent, right? If it was all raised to a 5-year felony or higher, comparable with arranging, is that something you would prefer or support? Or again, it wasn't a point raised by others. So, your thoughts on that? Yeah,
I'm happy to weigh in a bit. So there are instances, just kind of addressing that. There are instances of where it's not a plea down, like what we kind of colloquially call a butt grab. That's kind of the most common scenario where a stranger walks up to another person on the street, grabs their butt, and runs away. and that's kind of classic MSA.
Gotcha. But that even that could potentially be fourth degree sexual abuse, right?
Not if you can't prove force. You have to prove, or well, I think third degree is probably where you'd be looking. Or
right,
third degree
right,
in the
right,
current
third
scheme.
Degree. Yes, third degree in the current scheme. And it's the force question.
It's force. And force can be sufficient to overcome, right? And if you just kind of grab and run away, it can be difficult to prove force. So that third degree is often not a charge that can be sustained based on those types of cases, and usually is not a charge that can be sustained based on those types of facts.
Okay.
So there is an MSA, and that's the highest charge that we're able to prove. I did obviously outline our kind of thoughts on jury demandability, and MSA is one of the ones that I cited to. I believe there needs to be some sort of consistent with current law, non-jury demandable version of that. If we want to have various gradations, one, you know, for the first degree jury demandable, second degree non-jury demandable, or something like that, that's something we could possibly be open to discussing. One other, this is kind of a different suggestion that's not, that we haven't raised before, but perhaps also some sort of repeat. I know there is repeat offender separately, but perhaps specifically for MSA, some sort of felony option. For repeat offenders, there are some people in the district who engage in a long pattern of essentially butt grabs. That's just kind of colloquially what we call them. And the highest offense available is a misdemeanor, so there are certain instances where that type of conduct perhaps should be punished as a felony.
Okay.
And perhaps we could do that, but... Yeah.
So on the basis of that, I'm hearing though that like eliminating any jury demand by, you know, you want an MSA type offense low enough that it's non-jury demandable. That's
yes.
Okay, and you know this our proposal already with the 1 year would have had it higher at least for that, but so going higher from 1 year or 3 years up to a 5 year would make that maybe
it'll work.
This is Paul. If I can ask a question, I'm just curious about the reason for wanting to make it non-jury demandable.
Well, I think that's consistent with what we've articulated for all of the misdemeanors that have been proposed to be raised to be non-jury demandable. As you noted, MSA is a very frequent charge, and it's something that if all of them were jury demandable, it would just be extensive resources that have to be devoted to it, both prosecutorial and court resources. And I think that for a lot of the reasons that I've articulated for jury demandability requirements generally.
Good, and I want to come back to the jury demandability point, maybe on this, but also more broadly, maybe in just a second. But let me see too on this, like, if there's any more comments, kind of on this.
I just need to say one thing.
Elevation.
This was not one of mine.
Okay.
So I really have
the back thinking on it. Not sure.
To add to what was written there.
Okay. Good. Well, maybe we can check in on that or follow up on that if you have more thoughts on that. And you know, since it's been raised, you know. Definitely many other points to talk about, but let's move into kind of a broader discussion maybe about jury demandability. And we received, you know, a wide array of views on this point, not surprisingly. And you know, the short summary, you know, and I apologize and please correct me if this is inaccurate, but I think, you know, USAO's basic position was they do not support creation of new jury demandable rights for any offense. Keep, in other words, kind of status quo of current law as to what is jury demandable. Is that a fair?
Yeah.
On the other end of the spectrum, we have PDS, which is recommending making all offenses jury demandable, and particularly on that score, noting some of the concerns stated by the Court of Appeals in the Botto opinion a year ago now, 2 years ago now.
Year.
Wow, 3 years ago?
Oh. Last year.
Last year. It's time flies. And again, the Botto opinion was concerned about the potential immigration consequences and for a defendant, and took that into consideration, at least in the individual case. Now, again, there's been some ripples out from that. There was at least one follow-up case since then. And
but it was also limited to immigration. That was the only
again, limited to immigration. And perhaps, you know, again, the you know, court opinions are court opinions. You know, how much further those rationales extend, I'm sure will be the subject of future litigation. but PDS made the particular point that they did not think defendants should be in the position of having to assert an undocumented status in order to claim a right to a jury per Botto. And that the only way to do that, to avoid putting defendants in that situation, would be to make all offenses jury demandable. Am I recounting that fairly?
Yes, that's one reason why we think
one reason, right,
it
right.
has to be jury demandable.
Right. And
can I ask a question
yes.
about that one?
Yeah.
And excuse me, because I don't practice in adult court. So under, what is it, 14307, when you plea and you're not a U.S. citizen? How do the judges do that? Do the people, do they, in every case, no matter who the person is,
they,
give the 14307 warnings? Yeah, or do they, or does the person have to indicate something about not being a U.S. citizen to get the 14307?
My experience is what judges do during the colloquy is they say, I'm not going to ask you if you're a U.S. citizen, but if you're not a U.S. citizen, this is what you have to know.
Okay.
That, yeah, that's consistent with
is that. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
If you weren't born in the United States...
Then this would
then,
apply.
Then here's
these
some
three
potential
things.
Consequences.
Okay.
And I think if there's particular immigration consequences that have come up, the judge might say, have you had a chance to speak with a lawyer about those? And you have
yeah,
about
but, it,
them. But
it really,
generally, I find that that's what they do.
It really went to the question of self-identification
right.
or not. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Good, and again, just to summarize, so in PDS, all jury demandable, USAO, no new jury demandable beyond kind of current law. OAG had taken a bright line position that all what we kind of had put in the rankings as classes C, D, and E offenses would be non-jury demandable. This is like 3 months or less, kind of on the one model of absolute numbers, but that class B. Offenses, which again are around 6 months is kind of what we're aiming for there, would become jury demandable. So, but it's a bright line rule. So, in comparison to kind of what we had proposed, it both includes a number of additional offenses to make them jury demandable, for instance, particularly simple assault. In all cases, and threats, second-degree threats in all cases. I believe I'm saying that right. On the flip side, would not include jury demandability that we had recommended for some even lower level or even lower imprisonment time offenses, particularly dealing with demonstrations, you know, exercise, you know, free speech type situations, and attempts of an offense that was jury demandable, right? One thing we had suggested was that attempts of any offense that is jury demandable, subject to a half penalty for that, should also be jury demandable. And OAG does not support that change. They want, again, kind of a bright line rule. If the imprisonment penalty to which a person is subject to is a C, D, or E offense, 3 months or lower.
The only reason I don't want to say C, D, and E is because
right.
you had said
yep.
these are not written in stone. So
right,
the way
right. whatever the classification is,
6 months or yep. above would be jury demandable. Anything less than 6 months would not be.
That's right.
Whether in tempt or in coe or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I would rather phrase it because you said you may change these.
That's right. I mean, the classification is another matter.
Yeah.
I want to have a discussion about burglary in particular since everybody has thoughts on burglary or some thoughts on burglary. But yeah. Fair enough. So, but I, you know, I think it's fair to characterize the OAG position as being significantly different from what we had proposed, including a number of offenses, making them jury demandable that we had not recommended, but also eliminating a few at the bottom, and really using the imprisonment time as a bright line rule for determining jury demandability. So we have three kind of very different views on this. And I know historically, again, there's been a lot of negotiation around this point. Jury demandability also intersecting with oftentimes driving what the penalty is rather than vice versa in prior negotiations. So we have multiple perspectives, and I wanted to just, again, kind of paint out, we will we'll try to give some more background on this matter, but I think as many of you know, and certainly was raised in the Botto opinion, the district is one of about a dozen, 13 jurisdictions nationally that does not provide jury trials for all criminal offenses. Within that group, a few arguably do a bit, you know, more or don't go all the way up to close to the constitutional floor set by the Blanton-Baldwin cases at more than 6 months. You know, we go really close with 180-day, you know, a lot of 180-day offenses. Others don't go quite that far. So we're then even in a kind of a smaller group nationally in our limitation of jury demandable rights. The reasons...
I was just going to say, when we're talking about Badeau, I think the part that people are talking about most particularly is the concurring opinion. And just to be clear, that was a, this was an in-bank decision. That was a concurring opinion in which no one else joined.
Absolutely.
So it's, you know, one judge of an in-bank court. So I just wanted to kind of...
Absolutely.
I understand
And actually, since... Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's
since we're talking about...
Go ahead, Paul.
I'm on the phone, so I can't read
PRQ.
Yeah, no, just with regard to the Bottle opinion, I just wanted to us to remember a really important line from Chief Judge former Chief Judge Washington's concurring opinion. He says, most states recognize that a jury trial in criminal cases is critically important because of the stigma that accompanies a criminal conviction, and many of those states accept the fact that any period of incarceration, no matter how short, can have a devastating impact on one's life and livelihood. That's the end of the quote. I would be shocked if we're doing a kind of wholesale renovation, revision of DC criminal code, and our city council allows this dreadful state of affairs to continue. It's anti-democratic. I understand the U.S. Attorney's Office is concerned about efficiency, but if the vast majority of states allow jury trials when people are facing jail time and manage to have a criminal legal process that's efficient, I'm sure that the District of Columbia can do it as well.
Thank you, Paul.
It's interesting in the judge in the quote from Judge Ugast that USAO cites, even in 1993, and we're in a vastly different period now, as a practical matter, the actual number of misdemeanor jury trials is relatively small, and the vast majority of cases is disposed of short of trial. So that, you know, the idea that, that there's going to be an overwhelming burden for the residents of the district with how often they are called to actually serve on these juries is, you know, there's no evidence even then to support that this was overwhelming for district residents to come down and serve.
Aside from just jury duty, though, that, I mean, obviously, as you know, it takes far longer to prepare for everyone to prepare, both the court system and the parties, to prepare for a jury trial. It gets set further out than it does for a non-jury trial. So even aside from...
I think that's a function of the indictment clock right now and not necessarily the jury trial right or not the jury trial right.
But there are other things that come into play. If you have a... And disorderly was the example, was one of the ones you mentioned. You have a mass arrest, high volume arrest, 300 people. That's then 300 jury trials that suddenly get mixed in the middle of all your detained felons that have speedy trial rights, and somehow the court has to adjust for that.
Just as a point of comparison, I've practiced in two jurisdictions, South Carolina and North Carolina. North Carolina is a student. In North Carolina, many offenses are not jury demandable at the misdemeanor level, but you have by right a trial de novo in front of a jury if the bench trial does not go your way. So there's an immediate, essentially, appeal to a jury in those cases. And in South Carolina...
But essentially also a whole complete new trial, right? Like
correct.
This is essentially a duplicative layer altogether.
Yes.
Okay.
And then in South Carolina, the rule was, and I thought quite sensibly, if the state wanted to pursue jail time of any kind, that you were entitled to a jury on that case, regardless of the offense. That is also the same state that does not require that judges be lawyers. So I think that it's a strange thing that I think a system that is so behind in many ways had gotten to the point of saying that if you're going to put someone in a cage, that a jury ought to be a screening for that process. The bigger problem, though, is, and I think this is something that Professor Butler mentioned and that Richard mentioned as well, is that when you link in jury demandability to penalty, you distort the entire work of this process, which is to say, rather than looking at the wrongfulness of the conduct, we are now looking at what process we should afford this person when we're deciding penalties. And so an offense that we may all agree is very serious, we will put a 180-day penalty on it simply to avoid the process that individual would otherwise be entitled to. And so it, I think, corrupts what should be the core analysis in penalties, which is what is the conduct at issue, and what does that speak about the defendant's culpability in that case. And I also think that it distorts the charging decision process on the prosecutor side, which is to say, I should be making this decision based solely on what I have sufficient evidence to charge and not based on gaming the process to say, well, if I charge them with a lesser offense, they won't be entitled to a jury, and that may make securing a conviction easier. I also think it's an unstated assumption of this group that jury convictions are harder to get than judicial convictions. And I wonder what that says about the motivations of the process. So
we might want to talk to Chief Judge, because I thought that the court's internal stats don't support that. It is, I agree, a common understanding of people in the system that juries convict more than, or judges convict more than juries, but I'm not sure the internal court stats bear that.
Yeah, I will say from the court stats we've seen, and having had a few conversations with a person who used to work with the lab at DC, was very, very familiar with kind of this zone, this is at best a strained, it would strain any statistician's ability to kind of make strong or even weak claims based on the stats alone. There are just too many factors that go into these decisions about what's going to plea, there are just too many conflating factors. So I don't know that the stats can tell us one way or the other, was kind of the message I've kind of heard back after some consideration of this. Are these the harder cases that are going on to trial? Are these, so that's unclear. I've also heard say generally judges articulate, sometimes very strongly different opinions on this point, right? Some judges are kind of known for believing that, there's no difference between a jury, that they can, they will administer this just as well and fairly and justly as any jury. Others, certainly Chief Judge Washington, I think, put himself in this box by saying it has a notable difference, if not in the fairness of the proceedings, at least in the perception of those proceedings. And so judges' views, individual views vary. The stats can't sort this out, I think, by stats alone, There's a lot of anecdotal views about how important it is in terms of, you know, the outcomes. That's where we are. I appreciate Kevin's point that this procedural point has the potential and in the past has shown itself to drive other non-procedural points, right? Which is to say, it seems like a significant enough burden on just an administrative agency, you know, resource level, that it ends up driving a lot of decisions in the criminal justice system, for better or worse. What we will try to do is gather some more stats on this. I think, you know, USAO raised a lot of the arguments that have been marshaled before for putting the district where it is now with respect to jury demandability. Since of that time period, a lot has changed, which isn't to which is, I think, a consideration, right? The case levels, the concern that was articulated, particularly in the 90s, that jury demandability for misdemeanors is causing the district to step back from the aggressive prosecution it would otherwise take towards serious felonies. That calculus has shifted, right? I think, objectively, the caseloads are a fraction of what they were in the 90s, in the heyday. Even in the 2000s, not. Like, even 6 years ago. The fact that the district doesn't pay for the system is a whole nother conflating factor here. And by not paying for it, it also has no control.
Because we can't.
The supposed reasoning behind Mr.
Because if we were in it, we can't just say, well, there should be 84 judges, and we're going to fund the extra 20 judges because we think it's better for them to have it. So it does cut the other way also, where other jurisdictions might give grant, you know, give additional rights, can then fund, put their money where their mouth is and fund it. We have no control over the size of the court. They're down, what, 10 judges now? And so the judges have to, and I don't want to make an argument about the Superior Court and their ability to handle it. I'm confident we'll get, if we make this all, they'll deal with it. I'm more concerned about the impact on the other respondents, on the other defendants and the victims who are waiting for trials. So, but that's what I meant by both.
Kevin, can I ask you a question about South Carolina?
Sure.
So the prosecutor not seeking jail time being the sort of determining factor, I imagine, with respect to misdemeanors.
The offense carried.
That
was the rule. I know the official judicial rule was the operation of, I mean, the original rule is the state's going to seek jail time as a more retrospective look. But as a matter of practice in South Carolina, if the offense for which the defendant was charged carried jail time, they would appoint a public defender.
Wait, but with respect to a jury trial, what I understood you to be saying, maybe this is what you were saying, is that if the prosecutor's like, we won't ask for jail time.
No, they can't immunize themselves like that either.
Oh.
It was, if the offense carries jail time, you get a jury trial.
Oh.
So I had in misdemeanor, they call them magistrate courts in South Carolina, but they were small county courts. Offenses could carry 0 to 5 days, 0 to 30 days. You had a jury trial. In the cases where I would practice, or the courtrooms where I would practice, the only offenses that judges did not appoint attorneys to, and that you wouldn't see jury trials for, well, actually, you would see jury trials for this, is speeding offenses. But pure traffic, you wouldn't necessarily get a jury trial for. But anything more than that, you
know,
a jury
trial.
Oh, I
misunderstood what you're saying. Okay, interesting. Thank you.
Magistrates are one way to address the sort of, if there is a bottleneck.
I mean, and the district is unique in this situation, but I have always thought that it is a function of government to fund prosecution at a level that allows for the full level of process to take place, and that means also funding the component pieces like courts and making sure the jury pool is adequately sized and, you know, having a system there. But you don't remove process as a way of getting around financial considerations, and that if there's simply not enough funding there, then that should inform prosecutorial priorities, but should not be used to strip away rights of defendants.
Yeah, and, you know, right, the district is unique in the country for its funding mechanism and the control and the lack of control the district has over these choices.
And another
choices,
uniqueness so. Is it's not one state's attorney's office that could decide, am I going to bring this felony or those misdemeanors?
Right.
We have two different agencies that are dealing with unrelated offenses. So, yeah, I mean, there's the compound.
I agree with what you're saying. So I don't know if there's much more... We will revisit this. Again, we've had very different spectrum of comments coming back. In our next round, we'll put forward some new recommendations. We'll also try to give some more background that may be relevant as to where other jurisdictions are. While the court stats can't pinpoint the effect of jury demandability or not on kind of outcomes, there are some relevant pieces in there, right, that we'll at least examine and see what that shows. You know,
Richard, would a helpful point of comparison be to look at states where jury demandability is at a lower threshold than what's currently being contemplated and simply looking at the number of cases that are still resolved through a plea? So if it's still approaching 98% plea resolution or 90% plea resolution, it may be that our fear about how many cases are going to go to jury is somewhat hypothetical or speculative.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I think that's a fair point. I also think, like, look, we have felonies right now in the district, which, you know, routinely have 90% plus plea, you know, right? So even within our own system, we can say that, you know, the plea mechanism is alive and well as the main driver and form of disposition of cases in the district. Now, does that change?
I was going to say, even the fact that we have 90% in felonies, where that's actually a lower number than the national average,
yes,
around 95%.
I'm ad hoc saying 90. I think we might be closer to 95%. I'd have to check it, but you're right, Paul.
I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't note that. You know, I may be. I know I'm not actually the only former prosecutor on this board, or the only legal scholar. I probably am the only person who has been prosecuted for a misdemeanor in the District of Columbia and had a jury trial. And this was back under the old regime, where the District of Columbia was more like the majority of states with regard to democracy and the criminal legal process. And it's entirely anecdotal, but I feel like it made a huge difference in my case. And, you know, fortunately, the U.S. Attorney's Office, after the jury acquitted me, agreed to an expungement or consented to a motion for expungement on the grounds of innocence. I hope there would have been the same result if I had a judge trial. But it was very important to me and my lawyer, who actually, Michelle Roberts, is a former member of the Sentencing Commission. It was extremely important to both of us that we have the right that citizens in virtually every other state would have, the right to a jury trial. So, again, just wanted to
thank you.
Make that personal note.
I was going to say, just with respect to Kevin's point about plea resolutions, there are some other really meaningful changes happening in the RCC that I think affect what that looks like later. One thing that stands out to me most immediately is, in misdemeanor cases, we don't have any grades right now. There's very, very little incentive, unless somebody has a ton of misdemeanor cases, to plead to anything, because your exposure is going to be the same no matter what. If they say just plead to the same simple assault, there's very little incentive. Whereas the RCC has a lot of gradations for a lot of the misdemeanor offenses. There's just like less overlap and there are fewer gaps. And the fact that like the entire landscape of what's being covered by the definitions of the offenses, I think, affects the way that they're charged and the way that people evaluate what's lesser included and what makes sense as a resolution in each of the cases. So I think there's going to be a lot of sort of shift in those negotiations and calculations that are made.
And I was actually just going to make the same point as Patrice, that I don't know if this is anecdotal, but I think that cases are far more likely to plea as felonies than they are as misdemeanors for those same reasons. But even if you have gradations of misdemeanors, you still have, I feel like, less to lose. If it's a misdemeanor, particularly if you
think that the judge might not impose that maximum sentence, even if you do go to trial. And so, you know, I think that there's an interesting theoretical conversation about the jury trials, but I think practically, I mean, when I don't know the current numbers, but when I was in misdemeanors, we had four trials scheduled every single day. Sometimes zero of those would go, sometimes several would go. And, you know, unless we just hire a lot more judges, I just don't know how we could actually make that happen and have those numbers actually work. And I don't know if the answer is just we charge a whole lot less cases. And this with the domestic violence caseload, we're not, you know, not the general crimes, which I think there's differing thoughts toward. You know, I mean, a lot of these were assaults. I don't know if the answer is just to not prosecute domestic violence cases as the answer. I'm sure people have differing opinions about that. But I do think that, you know, realistically, there's just so many cases right now that I think unless we take into consideration the real practical effects of the extra resources this would require, and perhaps soliciting the chief judge's opinion on this, I don't know if that would be an appropriate function of the commission, but perhaps asking the chief judge about how this would impact superior court operations could be a useful operation.
When I represent clients on... Should I go?
Go ahead, Katya. Paul, why don't you go after Katya here?
I think there would clearly have to be a change in how the USAO prosecutes, but when I represented clients on misdemeanors, we have PDS clients who come in on felonies, you represent them in a misdemeanor matter potentially, and or you're in a misdemeanor courtroom, half of the trials are getting dismissed. So the trial call is a case screening function. The prosecutor doesn't know the witnesses, the prosecutor's out in the hallway, like, Ms. Complainant, Mr. Complainant, are you here? If you are here, please go to courtroom, you know, 102 for your jury trial to get on the witness stand. So the jury trial, that doesn't happen in felony court because there's an expectation that there's going to be a jury there and you don't do that, you don't waste a jury's time that way. But there is, like, I agree, it would have to be a monumental shift, but the shift wouldn't necessarily be that you need four courtrooms to do those four jury trials that are scheduled that day. The shift is that the USAO needs to meet with the witnesses, figure out what Brady exists, figure out whether this is a viable case that should go to trial, and make that assessment at some other point that is not the day that the defendant is going to have his or her chance to be free from this matter, which is the way that it works entirely now. And I wanted to go back to one thing about immigration consequences. And my memory is, you know, a long time ago, judges would ask directly a defendant where they were born. And the current practice, I think for most judges, is really to get away from that. And that the requiring defendants to say this deeply personable thing about themselves that will require deportation, I think is a total departure from how Rule 11 is now, that portion of the inquiry is now practiced.
Paul, come back to you.
I think I heard a veiled threat that the U.S. Attorney's Office might not prosecute domestic violence cases.
Well, it wasn't meant to be a threat. It was when people were saying we should reduce prosecutions, and I was saying that would be a type of prosecution we would have reducing prosecution.
I'd be surprised if that's true. Again, I think in other jurisdictions that, again, the vast majority of states that allow jury trials for domestic violence situations, those cases still get prosecuted. I can't imagine the district would be different in that regard. In any event, you know, I think that these efficiency concerns, I understand why we're talking about them, and I don't, you know, think we shouldn't be talking about them. At the end of the day, I don't think they're the most relevant consideration. Democracy is expensive. The criminal legal process is expensive. But again, if other states manage to handle this expense, I'm sure the District of Columbia could as well. So with regard to one of the efficiency concerns that was just listed, like what would happen to prosecutors who have busy misdemeanor calendars, I feel like my whole life is flashing before me in this meeting, because not only was I a person who was prosecuted for a misdemeanor and had a jury trial in the district, I also was a misdemeanor prosecutor in the District of Columbia. When I was at this Justice Department, I was detailed to the U.S. Attorney's Office to do misdemeanor prosecutions, and I spent about a year there. And this was in the old days when citizens did have the same rights that D.C. citizens have the same rights that citizens of other states have to jury trials. And actually, to have four ready for trial misdemeanor cases when we were going to court, that would have been considered a luxury. We would have like 9 or 10 each day that we went to court. And again, obviously all of those wouldn't go. Most of them wouldn't go. Maybe one or two would. The whole Superior Court calendar was much busier than now. But I don't think anyone would say that, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office wasn't doing its work appropriately and professionally. It handled its business, and I think it would continue to handle its business. Again, if we restore the democracy rights to D.C. that citizens of virtually every other state have.
Don, let me go maybe next to Don.
So just there are a lot of buttons that you can push to increase the efficiency of the criminal justice system. Large jurisdictions that have extremely high caseload volumes have instituted a requirement that arresting officers clear the arrest with a prosecutor prior to making the arrest, which radically reduces both the number of arrests and the number of no papers. And it increases the efficiency of their systems by substantially reducing the caseload of both prosecutors, and it has the added benefit of educating police officers about what makes an arrestable offense, thereby reducing their frustration after they make bad arrests. But there are lots of buttons to push on this to make a project more efficient. That's, I think, maybe where you're going, Richard. Our job is, I mean, we can think about all of those, but I think the core concern we have is just to make it fair. Our mandate is not to make it more efficient. There are lots of reforms that people can employ to make the process more efficient and keep it fair.
But, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but efficiency does leak over into fairness. Mm-hmm. If you have a lot of people who are locked up waiting for a trial, and you have a lot of jury, you have an expanded jury right, it's going to affect the person's ability to get a speedy trial. It's going to affect the victims who are waiting or the witnesses who get re-traumatized. So there is an effect that leaks over into fairness that goes beyond that the efficiency causes.
It's the OAG and TCPA. Everybody should be thinking about efficiency too, right? These institutions should be. That's just not our mandate. You must have a mandate. There's some discussion you guys have about managing the efficiency of the system in some other context, right? This isn't the only place where you guys get to talk about that. You probably talk to people in the court and PDS and U.S., right?
Laura, did you want to jump in something else? I want to move on to some other things. We've aired this a bit, but I wonder if there are any other thoughts about a middle path. OAG has come up with a bright line that shifts down by the numbers in terms of the offenses that, you know, would be jury demandable. Their proposal would include simple assaults, which is it's a top 3 offense or top 5 offense in the district, you know, in terms of just volume of charges and convictions. So that alone would be a really big shift, expanding jury demandability. Again, there are some others, usually more minor charges, that we had suggested be jury demandable, minor in the sense of being lower penalties, but I want to come back to the OAG approach. I think makes sense as a compromise kind of position if you accept the kind of fundamental premise that imprisonment penalties are the driver, right? You know, if you're looking for expand some but not all the way, and imprisonment penalties are the what we should focus on in terms of determining whether it's jury demandable or not, that is, that make the OAG panel proposal makes sense. The question I would have, are there other, what besides the imprisonment penalty should come into the determination of whether a particular offense and a conviction for that is serious or petty? And the court's analysis over this at times has evolved, right? For back the beginning of the last century, it was much more, oh, they looked at, you know, common law. Was this a common law offense? Is this more an administrative offense? You know, like, there was this mix of stuff, right? Over time, the court has moved to trying to suss out, again, legislative intent, right? They're always kind of trying to look through this veil of whatever the crime was that the legislature established here. How does that interface with the Sixth Amendment? And to say, look, it's the objective feature that we can grab onto is imprisonment, but always leaving this caveat that it's not the only thing, right? And that's what Botto really seized upon, was the seriousness, what makes this crime serious, is not limited to the criminal punishment tied to that offense. So the question is, what are there other ways?
Yes.
Yes.
So here's our thought.
Is this something beyond what was in the
cookbook? Passing notes.
Excellent. Okay. Passing notes. All right.
OAG's proposal.
Okay.
Plus, if an offense has immigration consequences, then it is jury demandable for all defendants. And that way, no one has to identify themselves as being undocumented or subject to deportability in order to get a jury trial. And any offense that would require sex offender registration, which might have already been captured by OAGs. And the attempt of any offense where the completed would get you a jury trial.
Right.
And any offense that would result in a felony recidivism enhancement. That you can't add up a bunch of non-jury demandable misdemeanors and then get charged with a felony.
Okay. Great. Let me follow up on one point in particular, which I, you know, is definitely at the core of your written comments also, on immigration consequences. You know, I have very little background in this that area. We've tried to like look into it some. I know you all in your offices, you know, wrestle with this, right? It's an incredibly complex area of law. What specifically is meant, and Botto wrestled with this too, and I think, you know, there are some different opinions between, you know, concurrence and the majority opinion. You know, is it a, when you say immigration consequences, how broadly should that be read, right? Because some offenses, and how clearly can we even state that, right? My understanding, like, of kind of federal law on immigration, has like some lovely language around, corruption, moral character, you know, fraud type offenses are treated a little bit differently, right? Like we're in the
some like whether it's your first or second crime.
First or second, you know, there are many, many avenues to look at whether any particular offenses. And while there's at least federal case law hashing this out for federal crimes, how that would apply to new revised offenses is unclear. So I think in order for that proposal to kind of to implement, you know, a plan like you're suggesting, we would need to be able to specify what, you know, do that work up front on the legislative front as to indicating what crimes are we talking about, right? And try to like upfront identify that rather than kick it to the courts to identify kind of on a case by case basis, is a particular offense under the, you know, have immigration consequences at this time. That is a way to do it, but I do think the more we could do up front to identify these are the offenses that we mean, that would be helpful.
I could probably think of language, but I don't know that.
Think of language. Yeah, the other thing is I don't know on this point, you know, again, Bado, Kelsey's helping a bit as we look into this, Bado's I think there was at least one other jurisdiction that has since, you know, kind of cited that in an appellate level case. Like, you know, this is happening. Again, the few jurisdictions that limit jury demandability the way we do, or similarly, you know, this is in the stew there also, and they're wrestling with the same problem, right? And there's going to be the same kind of question. Okay, well, when does this apply, right? You know, to what particular offenses? And so maybe we can look a little bit at if there's any kind of thing going on in other jurisdictions that would kind of indicate also what particular offenses have immigration consequences that would trigger the Sixth Amendment right, or a sub-Sixth Amendment right that we're, to the extent legislatures are working on something. So we can look at that, but I think that's going to be a struggle because simple assault, for instance, I would say, look, put aside immigration consequences. Traditionally, assault is, if not a crime of violence in the sense of having a severe consequence, the way we've defined it for most of the D.C. code, it is it's a classic offense against persons, right? In a way, it's a common law crime. In a way that a lot of the other misdemeanors we have around that 6-month mark are not. You know, look at firearm offenses, look at, you know, some of these are much more technical. They are, they're not malum in se traditional common law offenses. Is there a place to argue that, again, besides immigration consequences, that some other offenses should be treated more seriously because of collateral consequences, whatever the reason, that the legislature should say these are more serious, they're going to be looked at more seriously, they appear more serious to the community, and we should distinguish them. Besides the immigration piece, I didn't hear in any of the comments that we received back kind of like an articulation of a rationale, you know, to kind of seize upon that would help us to kind of delineate a middle line. If there are more thoughts
This is Paul. I think the Public Defender Service, it's not a middle line, but I think they certainly had a rationale, as did Judge Washington, that, again, anytime you have you face going to jail, that you should have a jury trial. So to me, that's a rationale.
Absolutely, and I apologize. Yes, I didn't mean to say that there aren't kind of like compelling rationales offered.
Yeah, so and with regard to collateral consequences, I mean, it's certainly the case that with immigration for people who are undocumented or don't have who aren't citizens, the consequences can be profound and different. Of character than other kinds of collateral consequences. But the reality is that, as, again, former Chief Judge Washington pointed out, the collateral consequences for anyone who is prosecuted for a crime in the District of Columbia are very large and important to remember. And again, we're talking about some people who will have immigration issues if they're prosecuted and convicted and, you know, deserve a right to a jury trial. But the vast majority of the people that we're talking about are African Americans. We're not talking about white folks in the District of Columbia because they, by and large, don't get prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office. We're talking about African Americans, and we're talking about a lot of African American young women and men who, if they catch a case and get prosecuted, will suffer extreme collateral consequences in everything from college applications to jobs. And so I do agree that collateral consequences are important, but I don't think we should limit our connecting the relationship between collateral consequences and jury trials exclusively to people who are who would have immigration issues. I think we have to think of, again, the majority of citizens of the District of Columbia, and especially the vast majority of people who the U.S. Attorney's Office prosecutes, who are African-American citizens of the District of Columbia.
I have a question.
Thank you, Paul.
So sort of taking into account PDS's secondary proposal that there's sort of this OIG...
I'm going to add gun offender registry to that.
Which I will add gun offender registry to.
Thank you.
I guess my question is that record. Is sort of about operation of some of these things. So the attempt or the felony recidivism enhancement seems like a pretty black and white issue. For the other things like immigration consequences, sex offender registration, gun offender registration, could the prosecuting attorney sanitize the factual proffer to avoid a jury trial in those cases? Could I put on a misdemeanor sex abuse case, not put on any evidence of age so that it's not sex offender registry eligible, and then would it still trigger the jury demand in your view? Or how do we articulate that in a way that makes clear?
I yield my time.
So
we have weird overlap, right? Like we have a registry statute that is not these provisions in the DC code are require sex offender registration. There's all these other things that are facts that are not necessarily facts that you have to prove at trial otherwise to make out the offense. And so it gets weird.
So it, for my limited practice in these cases, my memory, for immigration consequences, they will look at the actual fact pattern of what you plead to. So they will look at the actual colloquy. So it actually does not matter if the offense you plead to. So if I remember correctly, simple assault does not count as a deportable offense for a first-time offense. If, however, they can trace that assault plea to a domestic violence case and the party is identified as a domestic partner, that will still constitute a crime of moral turpitude for deportation purposes. So it kind of is bidirectional. You both would need to sanitize the actual charging offense. Sometimes you have to hide or have indictments dismissed and then have new indictments brought up, directly presented, so that it's harder for federal authorities to trace a specific plea for, let's say, simple assault to a fact pattern that actually involved a domestic partner. So you could be at a stage where someone is pleading on the assumption that the colloquy will not include mention of the victim in the case or their status, and then in the middle of the colloquy that gets revealed after the person has pled guilty to the offense or things like that, and now you're in the locution phase of it. So my critique on this project is that it seems like we're really just codifying the Botto analysis, and that it's always going to be, even if there's a factor beyond what we've enumerated, someone is always going to be able to say, well, the particular collateral consequences that I face, regardless of what's enumerated here, are such that I should have a jury trial. What if I'm a physician that's going to lose their license, and so my life's work is implicated by this?
Or a police officer.
Police officer, you know, and then you add on different fact patterns of collateral consequences, and I think what Botto, the basic premise of Botto is that the severity of an offense is not simply a function of the imprisonment, that you're taking the entire universe of consequences in deciding whether or not someone should have a jury trial right. And so that brings me to our original question of, we're doing all this work. There's going to be so much litigation over whether or not someone is entitled to a jury trial. I think we're just reduplicating the work that an initial trial and the actual substance of offense is going to have. Like, we're going to have motions on whether or not someone has a jury trial. They're going to have the jury trial. We're doing so much work to, I think, avoid affording someone a right that, I don't know, we as a democratic society thought it was important. And I think that value is especially important in the District of Columbia, where there's no local control of the prosecutorial function. And that to whatever values a jury trial right has in our society, they are amplified in the District of Columbia, not lessened.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one question that came to mind sort of as Richard was going through all the different ways to look at seriousness is, does everybody even agree that seriousness is what should be driving where we draw that line? Because just because that's where the court draws the line doesn't mean that that's the only basis for affording someone a jury trial. For example, when we were working with the council on all this APO stuff, the reason that I argued there should be jury trials and APOs is from a procedural justice standpoint, you have a police officer witness who a judge has to make factual findings about their credibility where a jury doesn't have to do that. That has nothing to do with Blanton, nothing to do with the seriousness of the crime, but it had more to do with just sort of from a procedural justice perspective, does this look and feel fair to the people who are there being tried or observing the trial, which is a separate consideration. And I guess I don't have a good understanding from reading the written comments what the lens is that everybody is asking us to view this through. Does everybody agree that it's about the severity or the seriousness of the offense or the impact that it's going to have on that person later in terms of direct consequences, collateral consequences, or jail time? Or is there another vision that you have in mind for what makes an offense worthy of a jury?
On that note, any last comments? Anybody want to respond to that? Otherwise, we will, again, maybe kind of rest on the briefs and turn to burglary. I think, like, you know, obviously we, as you know, Patrice just kind of articulated too, the nebulous line between serious and petty, which the court itself recognizes is not solely determined by imprisonment penalties. What else it is really hard to articulate. And that's what we are struggling with. And there are, I hear a number of, So we will continue to work on that. This may be a place where we come out with, you know, two options as part of our recommendations. If that, if this isn't a place where we can otherwise kind of get a majority to come together on. I don't know. We'll kind of proceed on this, but I do hope that I think it is useful to sever as much as possible the jury demandability question from the broader question of seriousness. But I also understand they're very much linked. All right, I want to turn to burglary with some of the time we have left. Janu. On that side, and actually, maybe actually close the curtain on that end too. It's hard to see the screen right now. I apologize, I didn't do that earlier. So I'm just handing out so that you all have, and I've got extra copies here. I give one to Patrice. We've had some discussions before about burglary. Some of them date way back. So I don't know to what extent, you know, this is kind of fresh in everybody's mind. But because we had a couple of different comments kind of noting that, whoa, this burglary penalty seems way low, right? I wanted to kind of point out some of the basic kind of reasoning and thinking on this point, and you know, open that up again to discussion. So what I handed out was a write-up from Wayne Lefebvre, who's, you know, we cite frequently. He's this, I don't know how old Wayne Lefebvre is now, but he's been around a long time. his name is on kind of the leading synthetic treatise for substantive criminal law. And he is not I don't think from what we've seen, kind of ideological one way or another, often very, but, you know, again, as a treatise, it's just kind of marking territory for where the general state of law is and the kind of describing some of the underlying rationales. So I take this as actually a very neutral, he's not coming with a particular advocacy hat on. And, you know, I just give it to you. You can read it on your own time. But, like, the gist of the opinion is or the statement, and he does not include this in most offenses, right? But for some, and burglary, and the other one is also robbery, kind of uniquely kind of hits these buttons too. And the concern is this. The categories of kind of, from a kind of a, looking at the structure of criminal codes and the array of offenses available for charging and convictions, burglary in many ways just doesn't make sense anymore as a standalone offense. Now that's a kind of a radical position. It's a radical position that was articulated 60, 70 years ago and was thought through and wrestled with. The Model Penal Code kind of grappled with this. And as the description kind of goes through, there's been an evolution over time from what burglary was in common law. It was a much kind of narrower offense in many ways. And the district's current statute, while still referring to outhouses and whatnot, and basically being very similar to what it was in 1901, it also reflects many of the changes that have happened in the 20th century to other burglary statutes. It's no longer confined to forced entry, right? There's no requirement of that. It's not confined to felony conduct inside. It's just intent to commit a crime. It's not limited to nighttime. It's not limited to homes, at least in second degree, or first degree if it's unoccupied. We like most jurisdictions in the country, have over time broadened the burglary statute. The basic critique is this. Burglary made sense both when it was narrower and when there wasn't attempt liability clearly laid out and or penalized at a significant level. The entry of a person into somebody else's a building, somebody's home, with intent to commit a crime, just as with our many assault with intent to commit a certain crime, was a functional way of getting at behavior that everybody thinks is serious and should be criminal. And that was before, though, general attempt liability was kind of commonly either recognized or significantly penalized. The RCC, one of the biggest changes we've made, right, is expanding and standardizing attempt liability across the board and making it, you know, a penalty that is half the amount of the underlying predicate offense. That, you know, is the underlying rationale for replacement of all of the what we call AUI offenses, the assault with intent to series of things. But it also does a lot of work in other places, right? Murder, right? We don't have attempted murders in the district. The penalties would be way lower, right? Like even for, you know, the maximum for a crime of violence, unless otherwise specified, 5 years, right? You know, it just doesn't, it isn't proportionate. We have these artificial cutoffs of 180 days for non-crime of violence and 5 year for attempt crime of violence that don't adjust and create some very kind of perverse, I think, effects on the system. So we've tried to address that by creating a uniform, you know, attempt liability. And it really comes to bear, I think, in burglary, where I think everybody recognizes certain fact patterns are really egregious. You know, the kind of stereotypical home invasion. Somebody, you know, the stereotypical scene is something of a stranger entering somebody else's home, maybe breaking it, whatever means, uninvited, perhaps at night, and committing therein a serious crime of violence or offense against person inside, right? This is kind of the most egregious. And the thing is, what typically has happened in the district, and I think in many jurisdictions still, is the label applied to that set of conduct is burglary. What we want to question and kind of problematize is whether, and that the most serious offense going on there is burglary. That may be the case in some instances. And we can talk about that. I think USAO kind of put a good hypo in their hypo in their comments. But in most cases, these egregious views of what a home invasion is would be subject to major penalties for attempted assaults, attempted sexual assaults, attempted murder. The inchoate nature of crime perhaps wasn't completed, or even more so, if the crime was committed inside, that should be the main driver of the penalty. What was done inside? What was the damage to the property? What was the theft? What was the assault against the person committed? These things should stand robust and be the penalty associated with it, whether it happens inside a home, inside an office building, on the street, should be able to account for that offense, that conduct. The additional thing that happens in burglary is, I think what we've talked for years ago, we talked about it this way, is almost like a location enhancement, right? What's going on is it is the assault that happens on the street when it happens in an office building with the door closed and when it happens in your home at night takes on different meaning and should be treated more seriously. And we agree with that, right? Like, that is the fundamental, the same conduct, because of the location, ratchets up some. The question, though, is how much, right? And how does that burglary charge, to the extent it is acting as a location enhancement, does it sit in addition to liability for the underlying whatever it is, the underlying property crime, the underlying assault, the underlying attempted murder, whatever, is that an addition? And you're getting a bump, basically, a felony bump, a 3-year, a 5-year bump. That's what we proposed. Having the low numbers for burglary that were in the proposal would stand in addition to whatever liability there is for the underlying predicate offenses. Now, we could play around with that, right? And make it so that it merges in some cases or not. But what we want to do is do a little bit different than what I think the U.S. Attorney's Office had articulated, which was that, this is a broader point too, that we want to find a statutory max that accommodates the most serious version of a crime. And they kind of, U.S. Attorney's Office made the case. And that is true, but I would add what kind of wasn't in there, which is that we want to make sure that the criminal code as a whole, the constellation of offenses and charges that may be brought, adequately reflects and provides enough punishment for that most severe form of that serious conduct. And it may be multiple charges here. Burglary, standing alone, shouldn't be the main charge for somebody who breaks in and assaults somebody, commits a felony assault, commits an ag assault. The fact that under current statute, an ag assault is a 10-year max, and merely entering into somebody else's home with intent to commit a crime therein, which, again, includes very trivial instances, which I don't mean to say are charged, but, technically are committed every time somebody goes to somebody else's house to, do drugs, right? Like, to distribute drugs, to, very trivial things. Second-degree burglary, a 15-year charge is triggered every time somebody goes into a store to shoplift it. Right? We've inflated burglary under the current system to be the big offense that yes, you allow underneath for it to swallow up the smaller predicate conduct, but we want to reverse that. And we want to say, no, that underlying predicate conduct, shoplifting, assault, sex assault, whatever it is, that should be the main punishment. That should be the main source of criminal liability. In addition, there should be additional liability for burglary because of the location that where it's going on. And together, put together these different crimes that are going to be charged or are chargeable up to prosecutorial discretion, are going to amount to an adequate punishment. I don't think anybody thinks that the kind of egregious home invasion circumstances should not be treated severely. But what we would suggest is that rather than let one offense, burglary, do all the work for accommodating and accounting for the worst case scenarios there, it be burglary plus whatever the other predicate offense is. And that what the overall time any defendant's going to face is going to be severe. There will be adequate punishment. But burglary itself may not be the lead one. So I think often attempt liability is going to come into play. I think, USAO, we can talk a little bit about the particular hypothetical they put forward, which was, somebody breaking into a home, appearing in a home, punching, woke a victim by punching them, which would be a 6-degree assault. Normally this is simple assault level. Threatening to rape the victim's young children, first-degree threats. Misdemeanor, misdemeanor.
Low level.
Or even alternatively, even if it was with a weapon, a kind of a first-degree menacing, so low felony, but still, is this, what would happen? I mean, under this, and I don't know what people think for this particular fact pattern, but one thing I liked about this fact pattern was that it avoids the question of attempts, right? There's just threats. There's one act which is, perhaps not super egregious, taken on its own, but in this context is very scary and traumatic. I don't mean to scary, it sounds traumatic. So the question is, even for this kind of an offense, and I think anything more, you start to very quickly get into attempt liability for assault, ag assault, kidnapping, sex, crimes, you name it, property crimes, all these might be come into play. But for this base level, would what we have proposed for a class 8, if that's a 5-year offense, 4 or 5-year offense, plus liability for these underlying predicates, first degree menacing, another 3-year felony, first degree threats, I think was a class A misdemeanor.
You're also assuming a judgment of both of them consecutively, which is not an assumption that should necessarily.
Absolutely.
But if we argue that it would be appropriate, I think a lot of judges would realistically impose them concurrently.
Absolutely. And I think we have made no recommendation as to consecutive concurrent for any of these, right? And under current law, that remains fully up to judicial discretion.
That necessarily results in longer sentences.
Right. Is that our goal one way or the other. Our goal is, as you had said, to make sure that the punishment available, not that will result, but is available, is sufficient to accommodate the underlying conduct. Now, I think this is a good case, right? Like, somebody in this, they're looking at, 6 to 8 years under these kind of two variants of the hypo. Were they to run consecutive? Were they to run concurrent 5 years? Is that adequate? I think this is in the ballpark where it is now. And that's why we, put this forward. For support, I would look at several places. One, I would look at where other jurisdictions treat burglary. I sent out the BJS, or maybe it's NIJ, sorry. No, this one's BJS report a little while ago. That includes statistics on sentences in other jurisdictions. These are state-level sentences, marking out the percentage of prisoners who served a given length of time before first release. And this is for the most serious offense. So burglary is the most serious offense. Time of first release just means where they, you know, subsequent parole violation doesn't mean a first-time offender. So across the board, across states, you have, you know, per the BJS stats, burglary charges 78.3% were serving, you know, less than 3 years, 91.5% less than 5 years, 98.1% less than 10 years. And just to go back again, what we have under the current statute, and as I understand the USAO proposal, is to keep a 30-year maximum for first degree and a 15-year maximum for second degree. Proportionally, I would say again, the 3 to 10 year range here is where almost all other states are in terms of, you know, what we see in terms of time served. The district is higher. The district, if you look at district court stats, are a little different, right? This is one of the few places where I think nationally the district imposes more severe sanctions than most of the rest of the country. Now, again, why is that? Burglary is a serious charge. It's considered a crime of violence here. It has these very large statutory maxima. It does the work that perhaps, and again, subsumes the place of what otherwise might be an assault, you know, even kind of lower level sex assault type behavior in the place, the location, the house, the dwelling, because it's available to do that more robust work. So it's the lead charge. It's the most serious. It becomes the most serious offense for this conduct. It isn't to say that, like, what's going on in those cases where somebody's getting a 15-year charge, for instance, in the district for a sentence in the district for burglary is somehow, you know, more or less severe. I think we would adequately account for that. I have right in front of me. Oh, here it is. So right now in the district, let's go over the court stats. So that 97.5% mark for unenhanced burglary sentence, first degree burglary sentences, is 10 years. So again, in the district, we're kind of at the high end compared to other states. But absent an enhancement, convictions for first degree, the sentencing is showing, and this is over 10-year span, right? Max of a sentence of 10 years. You add in enhancements, you get up to 15 years. Still nowhere near the kind of current statutory maximum of 30 years. Second degree, even lower. So again, court stats now would say, well, penalized a bit more than other states in district courts, still not near the statutory maximum. And the other piece of evidence that we kind of put out was, and got a little attention, there was one USAO comment at least that referred to, you know, the public opinion survey, you know, work that we did, right? Consistently, this shows that burglary type situations, while again, they see a bump, right? Kind of similar to an enhancement type bump, it is nowhere near the effects that we see in current district law, right? Nowhere near a 30-year offense, nowhere near a 15-year offense, much lower level. So I'd encourage everybody to look at those stats. Now, again, take all of these different data points I take with a grain of salt and not definitive. But what I want to suggest is that, you know, as it plays out, when there are egregious facts for a home invasion, it can, and under the RCC, would be sufficiently, under the recommendations made, be addressed through not burglary. That would be just one piece, a small piece, that would give a significant felony level bump. But it would mainly be about the underlying predicate offense. What was the underlying harm that was going on? So I hope that kind of recaps kind of where we were coming from and some of the background thinking that was going on.
If I can just make one point.
Sure, sure.
So in even these, these burglar cases at the 97, you know, this is very high end. Mm-hmm. I guess we don't know, but presumably a lot of them do involve cases where the defendant actually then committed some sort of really serious offense. Where right, so those penalties, you know, being sort of maybe even served concurrently with a murder conviction, a sexual assault, you know, something like that. So
that's
that
right.
may even slightly overstate sort of the high end of
that's right.
the penalties.
My one comment on that is I think it just misunderstands the harm caused by burglary. There are harms caused by the assault or by the threats or by the rape or the homicide, obviously, but the harm of the burglary is the invasion of the home and the invasion of your space, and that is the harm. And so there are other harms that can be imposed in connection with the burglary, but I think that that invasion is the harm of burglary. And I think kind of, I'm not saying you're pushing it to the side, but I think that kind of making that a secondary harm caused by the burglary kind of underestimates how traumatizing that is. Just the invasion of your home, even if nothing else happens, I understand obviously there's the intent to commit another crime, but even if just that invasion happens, that in itself can be an incredibly traumatizing event that, I mean, can, you know, lead to victims waking up with nightmares that somebody's above them or kind of, I made this point here that I think we need to think about statutory maximum is a very different conversation than mandatory minimum or guidelines. And I think it needs to involve different considerations than kind of just the average level conduct. But I think it does need to involve kind of what the worst possible version of that is and account for, you know, defendant's criminal history contributing to what that should be. If this person has committed 30 burglaries, you know, arguably they could be punished separately for each individual burglary, but that could also be a relevant factor if they're in this sentence is the fact that they've committed 30 previous burglaries that engaged in this harm. So I just kind of wanted to reiterate that point, that I think that the harm is the invasion itself, not just whatever harms may happen after that.
And I was gonna make that point. And in some ways, I think what I'm trying to grapple with is the reverse, not when it's a murder or rape in a home, but where it's would be a, say the butt grab on the street was the example that was used before. Having a butt grab on the street can be traumatizing for people. But waking up in the middle of the night with somebody over your bed grabbing your butt can really be traumatizing to people, even if that's only there. Even if that's the only offense that actually takes place because the person screams, the guy runs. And so I think that we have to consider the impact of the victim in the sanctity of their home as something that is, you know, the effect on them, and it's something that is worthy of consideration. It's not merely, I mean, I don't disagree with you. When you called it a place enhancement, that was a new way of thinking about it for me, but it is sort of a very specialized place enhancement to me when it's happening in your home or in your bedroom.
Well, I thought it was interesting, and what I was looking at down here is whether either of your offices had any criticism of trespass, and you didn't. And first-degree trespass is knowingly entering and remaining in a dwelling, and it was ranked at whatever the 6-month one was.
Was there a person in the home at the time?
No, that isn't an element of it.
Could be.
That isn't an element.
No,
of
it. Yeah, so, but that sort of distinguishes it from what.
Okay, so it is. So, but I do think that is. Interesting, right? So it is not just, you know, so it is a place enhancement and with certain degrees a person present enhancement as well, right? But how much does it kick that up, right? When you can also bring the actual offense, either completed or attempted. So if the person is there and you have evidence of a crime, then you have the other crime. I mean, I've been making this point about burglary, I think, from back when this commission was part of the Sentencing Commission. You've got the evidence of of an attempt or a completed other offense, charge it. And if you don't, it's an enhanced trespass. And how much more do we punish an enhanced trespass? And I think where it's ranked in Report 41 is appropriate.
Let me go back to kind of revisit a couple points. So I think one is to say, and I hope, you know, again, this is a helpful frame that USAO kind of raised the point about, look, fundamentally, what are in all of these penalty assessments, you know, how to do this, right? Right? Like, you know, and it is an incredibly difficult task because these are all crimes, except they're on here, and many of them are egregious. Many of them traumatize victims greatly, regardless of, and that can be very different than the penalty that exists. A trespass into somebody's house, there was a DCCA case, which is very, you know, stranger is found inside the home, right? There was no evidence of wrongdoing, and the burglary charge was thrown out. It was a trespass. You know, that kind of invasion of space, but with lack of evidence of intent to commit a crime, that's where the law came down. The harm, the invasion of that space, again, gets compressed into what is now a 90-day, trespass offense, 180-day. You know, so we have discord, you know, looking at the trauma imposed on the victim, on the community. These are all part, I think, of the analysis, but they're also, you know, not enough. I would submit that looking at, and right now I'm up on the chart, but, you know, one of the versions of the chart we put was arranged by class, right? And part of, I think, the most helpful part of the exercise for us is, like, putting them together, you know, like to like in terms of the series. Whether you're thinking of the average case, whether you're thinking of the serious, most serious case, what are your nearby comparisons? And I think, when we put burglary as a standalone offense, requiring nothing more, allowing for separate liability for whatever the underlying predicate is, given that it needs to be at the lower end of the spectrum, our survey evidence, public opinion evidence supports that. In general, kind of what we see other jurisdictions, penalties supports that. And I think the 30-year maximum under current statute, which the U.S. Attorney's Office is recommending keeping, does not enjoy any support in any of these places or in current court statistics. That's where, you know, just looking at the numbers. Now, again, that's not to belittle the fact that this can be a very serious set of crimes, fact patterns. We need to reflect that. There is a distinct harm that happens in these cases. All of those are true. But I think when we're looking at what the assignment is, look at the comparable offenses, look at the most serious version of it, but don't just look at the most serious version for this offense. My plea is to look at the array of offenses that can be charged for those fact patterns. Is that adequate? I think the U.S. Attorney's Office put together a very, like, you know, salient, poignant case. If you think under, you know, this fact pattern, you know, you add up kind of what the RCC does for this kind of fact pattern, the liability they face, consecutive or concurrent, that's up, you know, the liability faced, if that's inadequate, then we need to change this. Absolutely. But what I want to ask is that, you know, and you'll see in the next round, you look at the fact pattern as to, like, all the things that could be charged, and particularly give attention to attempt liability, right? That has become a much more robust, vital charge in the revised criminal code. And in some places, particularly like burglary, another of the assault with intent to commit X offenses, it does a lot of work. And I think we need to make sure that the conduct, the event that happened, is adequately punished. But it may be that it's adequately punished through, you know, a few relevant charges, that not there isn't just one that has to do all the work. And that's a departure from kind of how the district's worked in a lot of places, right, on a lot of offenses. And I understand that, and but what I want to retain is like a focus on overall is the penalty faced for a particular fact pattern acceptable or not. Where it's not, we need to adjust. And there's going to be real differences on this. I don't mean to belittle that. This is a place reasonable people can very much disagree and will disagree. So I look forward to, you know, conversations on this, and it's going to be hard. It's noon, so we need to wrap up for today. I will carry this over on the agenda as well as other material, right, the new outstanding drafts. We're happy to, like, again, meet with folks if you have particular questions as you start to review the new material. All the reports are fairly short except for the first one, 42.
That would be approximately that's for those
and,
of you within.
And that's obscenity and pornography and revenge porn, things which are shockingly hard and complicated because these are...
Because you didn't know it when you saw it.
There's a lot of legal conduct here that we want to not penalize. There are First Amendment issues. There are also some really egregious criminal conduct. So it's tough going. And also some of these statutes like obscenity... obscenity, at least, in particular, you know, just hasn't been revisited. And, you know, so there's a lot of there. I apologize for that, but, you know, we ourselves were rather sad to see the amount of work there. We're happy to talk through that with you. And, again, we'll hopefully get at least a one-week extension. I'll email you about that, though, in the next couple weeks.
When you finish,
go ahead. Yeah, I'll be off.